Yeah, the first proposal that I'm that is well that the one that is spoken about, I suppose, and getting a lot of media attention is what's referred to misleadingly as the woman's place is in the home provision. There is no such provision in the Constitution. The second seeks to transform the concept of the family so that it's no longer founded on marriage. Together, these proposals amount to a radical change in how we conceive of the family. They devalue women and mothers, in my opinion, and consequently children, and they amount to an attack on domesticity itself. In this talk, I'm going to set out the proposals and would suggest that they deserve to fail. And in doing so, I will defend the timeless values enshrined in constitutional provisions as they currently stand, and contend that far from being outdated or anachronistic, they represent a positive vision for society that we and our leaders would do well to heed. Although the government is proposing two distinct amendments to the Constitution, they are intimately linked, as they would be carrying out major surgery to articles that are currently intertwined with one another. So let's therefore begin by considering what the Constitution says now and what the government would have it say. Article 41 is entitled The Family, and it begins in section 1.1 by saying, "The state recognises the family as the natural, primary, and fundamental unit group of society, and as a moral institution possessing inalienable and imprescriptible rights, antecedent and superior to all positive law." This is a recognition that the family is a natural institution. It's not a social construct, still less a legal one. It's utterly primeval and intrinsic to the nature of mankind. The Constitution acknowledges that it is the family and not the individual that is the basic element of a stable human society. Because of this, and because of its pre-legal origins, the family must enjoy rights that cannot fully be described and which cannot be given away. These rights rank higher than mere human laws. Any attempt to infringe upon them would be contrary to nature and to reason. Article 41.1.2 develops these themes by committing the state to the protection of the family in its constitution and authority as the necessary basis for social order and as indispensable to the welfare of the nation and the state. Article 41.3 makes it explicit that the family, as that term is used in these provisions of the Constitution, is founded on the institution of marriage. The state pledges itself to guard with special care and to protect that institution against attack. In outline, the first proposal is to alter the text so that the family is no longer founded on marriage, but rather on family and other durable relationships. Article 41.2 comes between the two provisions I've just mentioned, and it states, in subsection 1, in particular, the state recognises that by her life within the home, woman gives to the state a support which, without which the common good cannot be achieved. And in subsection 2, it says, the state shall therefore endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in the home. So four marks can be made about that. The first is that this provision does not state that a woman's place is in the home. Rather, it recognises the value of her domestic life. The second is that the provision is centred on a place, the home. The third is that the second paragraph refers to mothers, not to women generally. The fourth is that the vision it presents is of a society in which mothers who wish to do so should be truly free to stay at home with their families. The choice should not be taken from them by economic need. What is proposed is that the two paragraphs in Article 41.2 will be deleted in their entirety and replaced with a new provision, Article 42B. So this will appear after Article 42A which was inserted by the so-called children's rights referendum some years ago. And it would say, the state recognises that the provision of care by members of a family to one another by reason of the bonds that exist among them gives to society a support without which the common good cannot be achieved and shall strive to support such provision. We can see immediately that unlike the current provisions, this uses the term family and will therefore be affected by the proposed redefinition of the family. Second, the reference to home is gone. Third, the value of woman's life within the home is replaced with the concept of care, which may be given anywhere and by anyone who comes within the broader meaning of family founded on durable relationships. So now that we see the nature of the proposals, why should they be rejected? Well, let's look first at the proposal to alter the definition of the family. As things stand, the family in Ireland is based on marriage. This has been the case since the foundation of the state and remains the case even after the Supreme Court judgment the other day. In order to explain why, it's worth returning to first principles. Why is society organised around marriage? Is marriage merely a social construct? Is it an invention of the patriarchy to control women's sexuality? No. Marriage is a natural institution, not a social construct. It's worth noting what the Catechism of the Catholic Church has to say about it. It says the vocation to marriage is written in the very nature of man and woman as they come from the hand of the Creator. In other words, the Church, which offers marriage as a sacrament to its members, says that before the existence of marriage as a sacrament, it was a natural institution. Marriage is, by definition, a sexual relationship. And the nature of man and woman is directed towards sexual union with each other. It's written in the design of our bodies. It's not something that's learned by conditioning or constructed by society. We see it in all species in the animal kingdom. Of course, there's so much more to a marriage than a couple's sexuality, but the sexual relationship between a husband and wife is evidence of their commitment to each other. Consummation is a natural incidence, a necessary incident of marriage. The sexual nature of the relationship defines it. No other relationship is like it. The state takes an interest in it because of its natural tendency to bring forth new life, new citizens. It is the Trinitarian rather than the nuclear model of the family, I would say, father, mother, child, that provides the building blocks for society. Anyone who's studied geometry will know that the triangle is the most stable geometric form. Stability is key to the family. And the reality is that it takes an awfully long time to raise a child. Unlike other members of the animal kingdom, human children are slow to mature physically, intellectually, emotionally, and morally. And what they need during that extended period of development, and scientists now say that the brain, the human brain, doesn't stop developing until the age of 25, is a stable and secure environment in which they can thrive. From an anthropological point of view, the child has a need for both parents, physically, intellectually, emotionally, and as a Catholic, I would say spiritually. While there are no absolute guarantees in life, parents who have entered into a public commitment in front of family, friends, and neighbours, and if they're religious, before God, are more likely to stay the course. This is borne out by all the statistics. The act of having to make a commitment to each other, to say, I belong to you and you belong to me for life, makes it, it's designed to make one consider more carefully what one is entering into. And once that decision has been made, it makes one more careful about sticking with it to the end, even in these days. In other words, marriage, at least how marriage was originally designed, and in fairness, how it is still conceived by most, is not contingent. It's a permanent state, till death do us part. Is natural marriage a social construct then? Well, yes and no. No for the reasons I've already outlined. And yes, because most societies see the obvious benefits of marriage to a society. Certainty, stability, people taking responsibility for their actions. Is it an attempt to control women's sexuality? Well, I must admit, I always find this one a bit amusing. Throughout history, women haven't had such a problem in controlling their sexuality. Even today, women are still regarded as the gatekeepers of sex. Our biology ensures that we are naturally more cautious when it comes to sex because of the obvious consequences. If marriage is a social construct and an attempt to control anybody, then it's an attempt to control men's sexuality, to have them take responsibility for their actions, to curb their impulses and direct them towards a more constructive rather than destructive end, to give them an environment in which they can engage in a healthy sexual relationship while taking responsibility. And also, it should be said, providing fulfillment and a sense of purpose in life. We can see why society might want to encourage it. Lone wolf males scouring the country in search of transactional, responsibility-free sex is a disaster for society. But some will say that not all families are based on marriage. Some couples stay together for life and are committed to each other without being married. And while there are many people living together who really feel a sense of commitment to one another, at the end of the day, they have not made any public commitment. And ultimately, it's the lack of public and legal commitment that makes theirs a legally undefined and contingent relationship. And this is what the Supreme Court was hinting at the other day when it spoke about non-marital family units and the difficulty of defining them. The Chief Justice in that case said, it is difficult to describe at what point and by reference to what characteristics should a non-marital family be recognised as an Article 41 family or the constitutional definition of family. Making a blanket statement that all non-marital family units are constitutional families leads to uncertainty and unpredictable consequences. Many people deliberately eschew marriage, saying they don't need a piece of paper to validate their commitment to each other. From the point of view of the state, however, and that is what we're considering in this referendum, the piece of paper is very important. It's the clearest evidence for the state of their commitment. What else is the state to do? Should it interrogate cohabiting couples about the level of their commitment? That would be an affront to dignity and privacy. The proposal seeks to address this problem by founding the family on either marriage or other durable relationships, as it says, but this is no solution. Certainty is very important when it comes to legal definitions. Legal certainty allows us to predict the consequences and potential ramifications of any particular law. We know what marriage entails and what it means. But what on earth does durable relationships mean? Who are the parties to a durable relationship? Does it have to be a sexual relationship? If it is a durable sexual relationship, then how on earth does that help the plight of single parent families who are not in a sexual relationship? They're no better off under this new provision than they are under the current one. If it is to encapsulate single parent families, as some politicians are suggesting, can a durable relationship be between any two family members? What happens if an uncle or an aunt is raising a child or a grandparent? Are they not to be covered? Does the family have to have children in it? Cannot two cousins have a durable relationship? Arguably, two cousins have a more durable relationship than two people in a romantic relationship because, well, they'll always be cousins. Does a durable relationship have to be a relationship with blood ties? Well, it would seem that the obvious answer is no, as two married people don't have blood ties. So just what is a durable relationship? The answer is we simply don't know. On the face of it, it could be any and all of these things and more. Any two or three or more people could declare they have a durable relationship. Remember, no official evidence is required. Now, presumably the courts would look for some evidence of a relationship, but again, this term is potentially so open textured that it's hard to see what kind of relationship would be excluded. Distant cousins, friends, pen pals. Is a long distance emotional relationship durable? If not, why not? And so after giving just a little thought to the matter, it becomes apparent that we can't possibly foresee what type of relationship might be encapsulated by the term. This matters because we are being asked to treat this amorphous and unpredictable grouping as the natural and natural primary and fundamental unit group of society. The family founded on marriage as a committed lifelong sexual relationship is truly a natural, primary and fundamental unit group of society. From that Trinitarian model we spoke of earlier, we see the primacy of such a unit through which new souls enter the world. For this reason, the sexual, intellectual, emotional and physical relationship between the spouses requires privacy and sanctuary from the state for the freedom of the spouses and their children. This is why the Constitution recognises it as a moral institution, possessing inalienable and imprescriptible rights, antecedent and superior to all positive law. But the question remains, should any or all other relationships have this recognition? How can distant cousins be said to be the natural, primary, fundamental unit group of society? How can three college friends who may or may not have a polyamorous relationship be said to be the same? Would that be a good thing? In declaring every relationship to have the same special status as marriage, the reality is that no relationship is special anymore. In other words, marriage and family are completely devalued. As we know from the past few referenda, the mores of a people are influenced by the law. Legalising abortion has led to a tragically massive increase in the number of abortions. Legalising divorce has led to more divorce and less marriage. When it comes to the law, what you honour, you get more of. What you denigrate, you get less of. Honouring the family based on marriage will lead to a better outcome. Changing its definition to say that family can mean anything you like will have that effect. Marriage is a good thing, and it provides stability and security to the family. It's good for children, it's good for men, it's good for women, and it's good for society. The data support that proposition, and if we're going to follow the science, then we should support and promote marriage and reject the attempt to redefine it. So let's look at the second proposal now. As we've seen, Article 41.2 is the provision that contains the recognition of a woman's life in the home. It also exhorts the state to support mothers who wish to remain at home, either some of the time or all of the time, to care for their families. It's proposed that the one reference to woman in the Constitution, two of the three references to home, and after the abortion referendum, the only remaining reference to mother are all to be erased. If the current wording of the Constitution is influenced by Catholic social policy, as some people are trying to make out, then this proposal has its origins in feminist Marxist ideology. Labour leader Ivana Bacik has called Article 41.2 an embarrassment, because it refers to women as having a life within the home and mothers as having duties within the home. She says it uses sexist language and refers to outdated gender stereotypes. She references the marriage bar, claiming that within our fundamental legal text, women and mothers remain embedded exclusively within the domestic sphere. I'd like to take these assertions one by one. First, her claim that this provision is an embarrassment provides a clue to the ideology that informs her general worldview. It's a classic feminist vision. And when I say that, I mean a hardcore vision of human relations and the family a la Simone de Beauvoir. De Beauvoir, the renowned second wave feminist, spoke in 1975 to Betty Friedan, another leading light in the feminist movement, of the need to destroy the myth of the family and the myth of maternity and of maternal instinct. De Beauvoir said that women should not be offered the choice of staying at home to raise children, quote, precisely because if there is such a choice, too many women will make it. In short, women needed to be forced to do what feminists see as good for them. When we look at the Irish government policy over the last few decades, we can see that women have been strongly encouraged out of domesticity. So, for example, the advent of so-called tax individualisation, as you'll be aware, was a major blow to single-income families. Beforehand, the tax-free allowances and standard rate band of a husband and wife were aggregated. This meant that the couple could take full advantage of the allowances available to each member, even if the income came from only one source. After individualisation, many such allowances go to waste unless both spouses have income to utilise them. So this has created a major incentive for both spouses to work outside the home. The National Women's Council, which is anything but representative of Irish women and instead just an elitist feminist talking shop funded largely by the government, has done its bit in shaping government policy and with its influence in media circles has ensured most of the public conversation around these issues centre on childcare, and more childcare, oh, and the gender pay gap. De Beauvoir's vision of paid employment is constantly promoted as if it's the only thing women want, with the subtext that children are nuisances and a stumbling block in every woman's otherwise stellar career. Never, ever do you hear them calling for freedom of choice for women in anything but abortion. There's to be no freedom of choice for women if it means they choose to stay at home to mind their children. Motherhood is a trap from which women need to be liberated. The erasure of women, of the word woman and home from the Constitution is just a further step in the gender ideology wars. Batchik says that the current wording is sexist and outdated and doesn't reflect the reality of women's lives today. Yet in order to bolster their claim that there is a gender pay gap, Batchik and the National Women's Council have been relying on the fact that in the vast majority of households, it's still women who take care of the household management and the raising of children. The ladies in the National Women's Council and politicians like Batchik say that there needs to be more recognition and acknowledgement of women's work carried out in their homes. And then they say, take that acknowledgement out of the Constitution. It seems to me that rather than being outdated and not reflected in reality, the opposite is true. Women do still provide an incalculable service to society through their work in the home. What really annoys the feminists, though, is that so many women, given a choice, choose it freely. While the feminists and women's rights campaigners say that the thoughts, priorities, and desires of women have changed since the coming into force of the Constitution, the reality is that the thoughts, priorities, and desires of babies haven't changed at all. Most ordinary women recognise this. We know it when our babies look at us. We also know that their babyhood and childhood is incredibly short-lived. And while it lasts, many women would like to have the opportunity to give their attention to their own babies and raise them, without feeling that they have to return to paid employment just to put bread on the table. According to OECD and CSO figures, over 40% of mothers of young children work full-time outside the home. The rest, roughly half and half, work either part-time or are full-time at home. We have no idea how many would prefer to be at home more from official statistics, because the question isn't asked, but the Iona Institute carried out a survey in 2016 and found that 17% of mothers wanted to work full time. That was all, just 17%. The following year in 2017, the Irish Independent, on behalf of Sudocream, carried out a survey of 3,000 mothers and found that only 6% wanted to work full time outside of the home while they had dependent children. The thing is that even mothers who work full-time outside the home make adaptations to their careers to suit their home life better. For instance, choosing a sector in their profession that's more 9 to 5, that doesn't require them to work weekends. Men rarely do this. I know from experience, many who work either full-time or part-time outside the home would like to spend more time with their children at home while they're young. Bacik also asserts that in the Constitution, women and mothers remain embedded exclusively within the domestic sphere. The claim that women are somehow oppressed by Article 41.2 is totally bogus. It simply doesn't stand up to scrutiny. This is evident in the lived reality of women's lives and achievements outside the home. I need hardly remind you all that we've had two female presidents, a female chief justice, a female Garda commissioner, female ministers, the list goes on. It should be noted that while the word woman is to be erased from the constitution under the government's proposals, the word women appears twice in the constitution, both times in relation to women's rights as workers. The Supreme Court has repeatedly emphasised that Bacik's interpretation of the Constitution is spurious. Rather the provision is to be read as acknowledging the valuable work that a woman does for her, the sake of her family, which underpins the stability of society. In the case of Sinnott versus the Minister for Education, Ms Justice Denham, the first female Chief Justice, wrote, "Thus in Ireland, in relation to the family and the home, women have a constitutionally recognised role which is acknowledged as being for the common good. This gives to women an acknowledged status in recognition not merely of the physical aspect of homemaking and family building, but of the emotional, social, physical, intellectual and spiritual work of women and mothers. The undefined and valuable role of the father was presumed and remained unenumerated by the drafters of the Constitution." Article 41.2, she says, does not assign women to a domestic role. Article 41.2 recognises the significant role played by wives and mothers in the home. This recognition and acknowledgement does not exclude women and mothers from other roles and activities. It's a recognition of the work performed by women in the home. The work is recognised because it has an immense benefit for society. Article 41.2 places an imperative on the state and not on women to organise society such that, should she wish to do so, a mother can stay at home to care for her family. There may be other reasons why a mother might want to work outside the home, and she's in no way precluded from doing so. The point is that it should be her choice and that she shouldn't be robbed of it because she can't afford to stay at home with her children. What do we make of these competing visions? Do we not think that it's a good thing for the state to try to support women who wish to stay at home to raise their children? The answer from the National Women's Council and other proponents of this change is clearly no. This isn't really about righting wrongs, as the politicians try slyly to suggest. Rather, it's about changing attitudes and behaviours. We all know this to be the case. Despite decades of social conditioning to the contrary, women stubbornly remain more interested in the domestic sphere than men. It used to be said that it takes a woman to make a house a home. How true that still is. Does this mean that households headed by men are not homes? Of course not. But the reality is that the majority of families are still headed by one man and one woman. And in the vast majority of cases, it's the woman who takes the lead when it comes to running the house, making a home, and taking care of the children and their needs. How many husbands do you think say to their wives, "Do you know, I think we need a few more pillow shams on the guest bed"? How many men know their children's shoe sizes? Now, maybe there are some men out there who say or know such things, but you understand the point I'm trying to make. They're few and far between. When I mentioned this to my own husband, he said, "What's a pillow sham?" The reality is that women are, and always have been, and I confidently predict always will be, more interested in the finer details of domesticity than men. That's not to say that men don't appreciate a nice home or that they're not involved in the rearing of their children, but rather that given a choice, more men would choose to go out to work than remain at home, while more women, particularly those who are mothers of young children, would choose to spend more time at home. Article 41.2 refers to mothers and their duties in the home. This doesn't suggest that fathers have no domestic duties. Rather, the provision is structured in this way because social policy envisages that it should be ordered towards allowing mothers in particular to remain at home. Why? Because economic necessity is going to force someone to work outside the home. And the reality is that, generally speaking, it's mothers who sacrifice a lot more and are more vulnerable through pregnancy, birth, breastfeeding, and mothering their children generally. And this investment by mothers deserves special recognition and generous treatment by the state. The proposal also replaces woman's life within the home with anyone's care, who knows where. The change from a specific location to none at all, I think, is significant. It is in the home that the family has special authority and autonomy. The home defines the physical boundaries of the family's area of control. It makes sure that every man's house or home is his castle. In other words, the family's area of authority is protected from unjust intervention by the state. The home provides privacy and security, which are essential prerequisites to the proper flourishing of the family. As another judge, the then president of the High Court, Mr. Justice Gavan Duffy, said in 1950, the cardinal position ascribed to the family by our fundamental law is profoundly significant. The home is the pivot of our plan of life. Home is the centre of every child's universe. Every child needs a place to call home in order to learn about the world in safety and security before growing to an age where he or she can go out into the world to meet it. But it's not just children who appreciate home, we all do. Home is the place to which we retreat when we are feeling vulnerable. It's the place where we can truly be ourselves. It's essential to the flourishing of the human person. So what are we to make of these competing visions for society? To my mind, this proposal does nothing for women. Rather, it erases them. It denies the differences between men and women, between mothers and fathers, between mothers and carers. It obliterates the name of mother because it wants to deny the concept of mother as an idea. Sex is irrelevant and gender is interchangeable. A mother is simply a parent who provides care. What an impoverished understanding of what a mother is. No warmth, no softness, no reference to the fierce, faithful love she has for her child. Instead, what replaces her all-encompassing love, which allows the tiny heart of her child to grow and flourish, is a sanitized, controlled functionary who carries out tasks that are deemed to be care. What a thoroughly depressing view of life, of human relationships and of the family. The present wording is clear. It refers to women who have children, mothers, and the care they provide for their families within the home. We know the parameters of what this means. And although every family is different, there is a universal understanding of what a mother does for her children and what she does to make a home. Making a home for the benefit of children so that they can be raised in a secure and stable environment in which they are cherished and loved for who they are. Take away the constitutional recognition of that setting. Take away the constitutional recognition of the woman who, in the vast majority of households, makes and maintains that setting, and what happens? It undermines the family. It undermines the family's security and stability and privacy and sends out a message, the kind of care that mothers provide in the home for the benefit of their families is just the same as any other kind of care. And to the extent that mothers choose to stay at home to minister to their families, they themselves are an embarrassment and outdated. It can certainly be argued that successive governments have not made good on the promise implicit in Article 41.2, that they should create a society that supports a woman's choice to spend more time at home with her family. However, the present referendum does provide an opportunity to us to let the political class know that we expect better from them, and that they should honour women's chosen role as a homemaker and mother, rather than attempting to impose their own vision on us. If you cherish the family founded on marriage as the true building block of society, if you hold in high esteem the domestic life of women and mothers, if you value the home and domesticity itself, if you believe mothers should be supported in their choices to care for their own, if you reject the interchangeability of the sexes and sterile, bloodless concepts such as care and durable relationships, then I urge you to use your vote and send a rebuke to our leaders. Please vote no to both proposals. Thank you.